we are not necessarily motivated just by facts and figures in an important part of a presentation, but facts alone, information alone is not enough. We have to be connected with each other on an emotional level. Well, guess what? There is a tactic, there is a tool that we have, that we've used for hundreds of thousands of years to connect with people. Story.
Welcome to the Speaker Driven Business Podcast for the entrepreneurs, the subject matter experts, and the difference makers who want to unlock the power of speaking-driven strategies to accelerate impact, influence, and revenue. I'm your host, Jacqueline Nagel, and this is the place for straight talking, easy to implement 20-minute or less business, speaking, and communications insights and lessons, which will help you break through from unheard of to in demand. Let's go. Carmine Gallo, welcome to our world.
Jacqueline, thank you. It's really nice to be able to talk to you and to our listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Carmine, we do have your official bios. We're doing all the right things. Your official bios are going to the show notes with this conversation. We can actually Google you and see them really fast. And we feel like we've got to know you through your books, especially on the other side of the world from you. What I'd love to know, though, is in your own words, who is Carmine Gallo and how did you get here?
Well, I'm passionate, I would say obsessed about communication. And that goes back to high school, I think, where I started reading books on, you know, history books on Winston Churchill and a lot of famous speakers. And then in college, I began to gravitate toward public speaking and speeches. And I loved listening to great speeches, whether it was presidential speeches or even corporate, you know, speeches back then.
Yeah.
And I began to be fascinated by the fact that someone can use their words and another person like myself could get goosebumps from those words.
Yeah.
How does that happen? So I really just became obsessed with communication and writing and translating ideas into words, just in all of those different facets. And I've just never really let go. I've just been tremendously I use the word obsessed because I am. There isn't one day that goes by where I don't find something related to communication that I would like to improve or something that impresses me. So it really is my passion.
I love the fact that you've actually created an entire career, global career, out of an obsession. And I have a son who works in politics and is in research. And he says, Mom, I get paid to nerd out on this stuff. Right? So it kind of sounds like the same sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It is. You get paid to follow not only your passion, but what the type of thing that you would probably be learning or doing anyway, whether or not you got paid for it. So it's a nice combination.
Absolutely. So when I actually, because I have inhaled all of your books over time, and when I actually look through those, there is one time where you give a glimpse where you were a lawyer, you gave that up to go to broadcast journalism, then you ended up, you know, in this space that you're in now. How did you actually, because lawyers can be great storytellers, but the majority of them aren't. Broadcast journalists are great narrators, and I've seen a lot of broadcast journalists not transition to storytelling very well as speakers. What is it that you think actually pulled you through all of those, and what did you take from those particular facets into what you do now?
Well, just one clarification. I almost went into law.
So you decided before you got there.
At the last minute, but that's okay because I do talk about that a lot. I studied law and last minute I decided, I don't think this is for me. Simply because when you study law, and I studied it in college and I was prepared to go in that direction, you study like these grand cases. You study the big cases, the milestones. And then you begin to realize that everyday law is a lot of paperwork. It's not, you're not a big trial attorney or in front of the U.S. Supreme Court or anything. And then obviously I began to realize that the way lawyers communicate too is very convoluted because they're using, you know, Latin-based words instead of just plain English. So that experience was really important for me to gravitate toward what I would eventually end up doing and what my passion would be, which is communication.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. What prompted the shift? because you actually speak in one of your books about actually shifting into broadcast journalism and wondering whether your father was going to be okay. But what prompted that shift into broadcast journalism? Why did you choose that?
What am I going to do? Let's see. I love words. I love ideas. I love current events. Don't want to be a lawyer. What am I going to do next? Speech writing, maybe? Let's give that a go. But I'd rather be the person giving the speech, not the one just writing the speech. I'd want to be the face of the speech, too, because they're my ideas and I want to share them. So that's not going to work out. Well, I love current events. How about journalism? So I got a master's degree at Northwestern. I went to UCLA for an undergrad, went to Northwestern, got a master's degree in broadcast journalism, and spent the next 15 years of my career in broadcasting. So probably spent a little longer than I would have, I think, looking back. But that it taught me how to write, how to speak, how to deliver. But it also taught me the gap, the problem that needs to be solved, which is very few people are good on television. Very few people are good spokespeople for any topic. Which is why when I worked at CNN and some other platforms, we would often go back to the same spokespeople. We went back to the same people time and time again every week. When I worked briefly in New York City, I would say, but there are 1,000 economists. There are 1,000 analysts. Why do we only go back to the same five or six? Oh, because they're the people who can best translate complex ideas into simple sound bites and quotes that anyone can easily grasp. Light bulb goes off. Light bulb, Carmine, there's a need out there for people to communicate more effectively. So that's how I got into writing and coaching.
And coaching. And I think that's actually fascinating because we see all the time, like, you know, in the expert field or even, as you know, with people who are CEOs and founders of big businesses, we see all the time that they're not quite cutting through. They're not quite getting that position. It's always, you know, I can't break through that inner circle of five or six that the media always go to or that the, you know, the big clients always go to. My thing is, it's never the market. It's always you, right? And usually it's your communication. So that's actually what you're articulating there is you really saw that people don't invest enough in actually that one core skill that will change the game for them. Is that what I'm hearing?
Absolutely. And I think that because I like putting pieces of the rhetorical puzzle together, I'm very good at, I've just realized this over many years, what I am good at is analyzing. Why is this particular TED Talk very good? Why is this particular speech well received? Why is this presentation so effective? And that's how I started writing books.
Yeah.
One of my first most popular books was on Steve Jobs because Steve Jobs was considered, and I still consider him, one of the best business storytellers of all time. What exactly did he do? And so I put on my creative hat and also my journalist hat, and I began interviewing people who knew him or people who worked directly with him to create and design his slides that he would use for presentations. And I approach the same with TED Talks too. So I like the whole idea of applying my passion for communication and my experience and passion for investigative journalism, figuring things out and explaining it to people.
I think also too, you just actually earlier you said about there was a lack of people who could distill complex ideas into something simple. Is that actually the role that you've taken on? You're looking at these fascinating speeches and this incredible, powerful formats. Do you think that's actually the role that you've taken on in your own work?
I feel like my work is best suited for people who have big ideas, complex ideas, because that's hard.
Yes.
Creating a pitch or a presentation around a solution to big problems, really complex problems that don't always fit into 140 characters online. That's hard.
It is.
That's hard. And that's in California where I live. So I've been able to work with people who represent or have companies around cloud computing, technology, healthcare, farming, you know, where your food is coming from, and certainly energy, you know.
Yeah.
What are the problems with energy? What are the solutions? Well, the solutions are incredibly complex. very complex, very hard for people to articulate. So I enjoy that. I enjoy taking complex ideas and getting my hands dirty into the real messy middle ground where I think most good solutions lie, not on the polar extremes, but in the middle. But how do you articulate that? And how do you get, how are you heard through the noise? That's hard.
It is.
If persuasion was easy, we would all be able to persuade anybody of anything. No, persuasion is very difficult. So I think there's always new tactics, new tools to learn and to pull from in a rhetorical tool belt. I like to give people tactics. Yeah. Let's see what works, what doesn't, and we'll adjust.
Amazing. You actually rattled off a whole heap of industries there that are by nature very technical and very complex. Now, the majority of people in those spaces, and I've worked in a lot of those spaces, the majority of people in those spaces will tell you this is technical and logical. You have some really great examples of where story changed the game. Why is storytelling important in complexity and also very technical spaces?
Yeah, we have to get away from this idea that the spaces that are too technical or don't lend themselves to story or effective communication. It's more important in highly technical and complex areas that you, as a person with those ideas, if you want to get buy-in for those ideas, then it's more imperative than any other field that you communicate succinctly, concisely, and in a simple way that anybody can understand.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, let me give you one quick example. I live near a government lab that does a lot of advanced scientific research. So I was speaking to one of the scientists who is a female named Annie Kreicher. You can look up our video. It's online. And I had an interview with her. She was named to Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People because of the kind of work she's doing, which is in an area called nuclear fusion, replicating the sun's power on Earth to create milestones and the foundation for renewable energy. So I got a tour of the lab. I got a tour of the lasers they're using. It became global news when this happened. So I talked to one of the premier scientists on the program, Annie Kreicher, and I asked her, explain what you do to a non-expert. And she explained it pretty much like I just told you. Well, it's replicate. Yeah. It's kind of the holy grail of science. She used the holy grail of science. So she's using like a metaphor. And then she's taking an example that I would know. So Carmine, sort of like taking the sun's energy, trying to create that energy in a controlled setting so that hopefully it'll pave a path for a renewable energy future. Oh, okay. I kind of get that. I'm okay with that. And then I decided, before I let you go, Annie, would you give me the same definition or description, but to another PhD or another scientist in nuclear physics without missing a beat? She completely translated it. I always have to read it when I deliver it to audiences because it has to do with isotopes and deuterium temperatures and absolutely so convoluted that the average person would have no clue, no concept as to what she's talking about. Completely different language. But she could do it seamlessly. And I asked her, there's something going on here. How can you go from speaking to one audience, non-experts, to speaking to your peers very seamlessly from one second to another? And she said, we have to train for this. We train for it. Effective communication, simple communication, being able to translate it to different audiences is critical if you want to get buy-in for your project.
Yeah.
Of course. Not just for scientific government lab, but for any project. If you want to get buy-in, you have to be able to translate what you do to different audiences. And if you don't have that skill, that can hold you back in so many ways in so many careers.
Yeah, absolutely. What's the most powerful example that comes to mind of actually shifting gears, going from that really technical speech to that very story-based translation simplification? What's something that really springs to mind for you in that space where somebody really nailed that transition?
Well, certainly the one I just gave you was a fantastic example. But I love listening to scientists, especially, who can communicate in ways that are simple. But I watch a lot of corporate and I watch a lot of business people as well, whether it's Apple.
Mm-hmm.
That's why Steve Jobs was considered brilliant at what he did, because he knew how to translate highly technical material for his customers and consumers.
Yeah.
People who did not care about how many gigabytes are inside a particular machine or product. Okay. Like, remember, the first iPod was 5 gigs of storage. He realized not one person cares that that is 5 gigs of storage, but they do care that it was the equivalent of carrying 1,000 songs in your pocket.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's an interesting one. Well, I want that. I want that product. Yeah. Well, why don't you want a product that has 5 gigs of storage? Oh, that's not interesting. But 1,000 songs in my pocket? I love it. That's great.
Absolutely.
Steve Jobs was brilliant at that. So he was so far advanced for his time. And you know what, Jacqueline? None of his slides, this comes back to some of our, I know we'll be getting into this, like TED-style presentations. None of Steve Jobs' slides ever had bullet points. So he was way ahead. Or he was way ahead of his time. Because to this day, most presentations are overloaded with text and bullet points. His was graphics and imagery and animation. He wanted to build an emotional connection with you, not to put you to sleep.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I also think that because he did that at the time he did it, it was a real cut-through moment because people weren't used to that visceral response to a presentation and things like that. And we are definitely going to double back to that because I really have a love-hate relationship with PowerPoint. I think when it's all your slides, I think when they're used well, they add to the experience. But I think 95% of the population still dot point and bullet point.
I was just going to add, but they are rarely used well to this day.
Yeah, very rarely used well.
And I have a theory for that too, but we could talk about it later.
Oh, I'm going to bookmark that one to come back to. We're talking about storytelling. One of the things that bubbles up in a couple of your different books is the 4 questions that you walk people through to get them from that logic to actually getting to the heart of the story, like what actually makes their hearts sing. Can you actually just share those questions with the audience? Because I love that process.
Yes, they are a group of questions that I have started to use to get to the core of who you are and what your message is. They start broadly and frankly, they're actually just a way of looking at questions through my own internal struggle of how do I get the best stories out of people?
Yeah.
So this is how they evolved, okay? So the first question was almost always when I'm working with people, tell me what you do. Well, the answers to that aren't very exciting because when you ask people, tell me what you do, you get titles like I'm a healthcare director.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you get titles and just real basic things, but you kind of need those questions. You need that. Okay, so I sort of need that before I can really help a speaker. Okay, what do you do? Tell me more about what you do. Tell me more about the company. What does it do? But it's not very interesting. So then I started asking, well, what are you passionate about? Right? That seems like a common question.
Yeah.
Instead of just what you do, what are you passionate about? And that's an okay question because then people will say, well, I'm passionate about healthcare and giving people a better experience, customer care, things like, okay, all right, that's not bad. It's a little more interesting than what do you do, which almost always goes to a resume.
Yeah, the CV check.
Exactly. So I started asking another question. Well, why do you do what you do? Oh, well, you know, Carmine, healthcare is very important. And did you know that 22% of people 55 and over don't have access to this type of healthcare? Well, okay. All right. So now I'm starting to dive a little bit more. I'm starting to get a little bit more from you as a speaker, but there's still no emotion. There's no stories. So then I added a final question. This comes back to Steve Jobs, learned it from Steve Jobs and Apple. Steve Jobs paused at the end of a major presentation and he said, and I think it was sort of off the cuff. I don't think it was planned. And he said, you know, it's the intersection between technology and liberal arts that makes my heart sing.
Boom.
And I thought, bingo, light bulb moment. That's the question. Let me turn that into a question. So now I go through kind of a process. What do you do? What are you passionate about? Why do you do what you do? But then I always end with, okay, now think about this one. What makes your heart sing?
Yeah.
And more often than not, people will pause and they won't give me their resume. They won't give me their title. They won't go into facts, figures, and data. They'll say, what makes my heart sing? Well, you know, when I was younger, my mom went through a health scare, and she didn't have therapy available to her back then. I began to realize maybe this is the journey I should make in my life. Oh, okay, now we're getting into story.
Yeah.
Now we're getting into the core of who you are, which I think that's what a good origin story does, a good backstory.
Yeah.
Will reflect who you are and why you do what you do and what your values are. So again, we're looking at that puzzle. How do we get people to be the best speakers they can?
Yeah.
It's not always easy. We have to come up with structures and methods and tools and tactics to get the best presentation from people.
Yeah, it always surprised me. I did a number of years working with gold medal Olympians here in Australia through the Australian Institute of Sport. And the whole idea was I was brought in as the storytelling skills mentor because they realized that they needed to get the gold medal Olympians to share stories of their experience for the younger generation coming through, right? So what could they expect? And some realities about the stress and the pressures and the things like that and those moments of truth. And it always fascinated me that when I sat down with them, the first response, and some of these are people that in Australia, like they're our household names, right?
Yeah.
And they're incredible Olympians and they've done not just one or two gold medals, but multiple, and they're in service to others. They're now mentoring the next generation of Olympians.
Mm-hmm.
And the first response to my question was, what stories would you like to start with? Was always, I don't have any stories to share.
Mm, yeah.
The first few times it happened, I just thought, oh, this is just the people I've got. I didn't really think it was a thing, but then it became consistent and I had to get very clever at guiding them into finding their stories. I'd love to know from you, when someone says, I don't really have a story to tell, how do you get them to gather up their stories?
Look, when I was in journalism, day one or the first week, not journalism, but when I went to journalism class, I remember going out on a project, coming back, and that's what I said. I told the instructor, oh, there's no story there. And that was the last time that happened. Because
I'm really
he was
glad
very
to hear
angry,
that.
Very angry, raised his voice and said, Gallo, there's always a story. Yeah, he was right? There's always a story. And so people are natural storytellers. That's okay. That's what we do because we enjoy it so much. Not everybody is a novelist. Not everybody's a screenwriter. They're not looking at their lives through the lens of story. And yet, this is important. We should talk about this. Storytelling is who we are. We are storytellers. Yeah. It's in our DNA. We now know that.
Yeah.
In the lab, they are finding things that the way our brain is structured, the way we communicate with each other, they're finding things that we've known intuitively for hundreds of thousands of years, which is why our cave-dwelling ancestors would sit around a campfire and tell stories. And stories spark their imagination and stories, that's how we became explorers and curious people. And that's how we learn things. That's how our species became so dominant, was through stories. We are all storytellers. I just don't think that when you're in a professional setting, you don't see yourself as a storyteller.
Yeah.
But what I tell people is when you start seeing yourself as a storyteller, the presentation that your audience sees will change. Significantly, much more impactful.
What is it that changes about the presentation? Once somebody steps into seeing themselves as a storyteller, what is it that changes that the audience feels?
Well, let's talk about TED Talks if we can.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of the rules of the TED commandments, as they say, is thou shalt tell a story.
Yeah.
And I think they have to put that down as a rule because exactly what we're talking about here, people don't see themselves as storytellers. So it's all about the information that I want to share.
Yes.
I have facts, figures, arguments, evidence, data, and I can't wait to give you all of my analysis. But what the gap and what they need to realize is that most people and most of the time, behavioral psychologists have figured this out, we are not necessarily motivated just by facts and figures. In an important part of a presentation, But facts alone, information alone is not enough. We have to be connected with each other on an emotional level. Well, guess what? There is a tactic, there is a tool that we have, that we've used for hundreds of thousands of years to connect with people, story.
Yeah.
So why aren't we using stories in our public presentations? That's why I think the TED organizers have had to say, we want to hear a story. Because if you don't say that, if you don't make that more of a rule, a guideline, then people won't tell you a story.
I think that's fascinating that it actually has to be a TED commandment. It's not just a given that it's about the stories. One of the things that I find really interesting with this, though, is, you know, I talk about, you put in, is storytelling important in communication to Google? You've got 1.3 billion responses in 0.3 of a second. We actually all know storytelling is important at a macro level, right? You have a flourishing practice with what you do and the thought leadership that you do. Why is it that people like you need to exist? Like, if we know storytelling is important at this logical level, why are so many stories told badly?
Because, again, I don't think that this is what people have fires to put out every day.
Yeah.
They're busy with doing what they do best.
Yeah.
But like I said, they're not novelists. Most people have not taken a creative writing course. Most people don't analyze film.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, most people don't do screen. They don't take a screenwriting course. And if they did, it would be because they're screenwriters.
Yeah.
Not all screenwriters are good presenters. There's a blending of these worlds that I just think is, I don't judge people at all for this. I just think that they are busy doing whatever it is that they do to be experts in their field. And they don't think about themselves in this way. And that's okay. That's what I do. That's why I'm trying to learn things from different people who are either in the creative arts or who are highly technical, but have that skill of storytelling. And so more often than not, there are many people who I interview or who I've talked to, experts and business leaders of all types, who often are the ones who bring up storytelling to me. Mm. That's why I've written books just on storytelling.
Yeah.
And this is an interesting anecdote. I was speaking to a very high-profile venture capitalist in Silicon Valley. This was many years ago. And I made the mistake of saying, well, you know, I teach the soft skills, like storytelling. Okay, mistake. I've never done this since. Boy, he really let me have it. He said, oh, well, hold on, Carmine. You call it a soft skill. I call it fundamental.
Yeah.
Because if you're an entrepreneur, you can't tell me a story. You can't convince me to come along on this journey, then I'm not investing in you.
Yeah.
That's it. So you can have a great idea, but you're not going to get funded.
Yeah. And that's, you know, and for everyone listening, the people in my world know that I say those sorts of things all the time. I'm a pitch coach in the startup and innovation space. And to hear you actually confirm that the venture capitalists in Silicon Valley, who are like the gurus and the gods of this space mm-hmm. on the world, are actually saying, if you don't have a story, I'm not investing, full stop. I just want everyone listening to really hear that. In your opinion, Carmine, is everyone capable of becoming a powerful storyteller?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm not just saying that as a coach. It's because I've not only seen it anecdotally, but I've read about this. There isn't one person who we admire just on a global level. There isn't anyone who we really admire as a communicator, whether it's current or historical, who hasn't worked at it.
Yeah.
And I go back to I did a lot of research on Martin Luther King when I was writing some of my books. And Martin Luther King worked at it.
Very hard.
There were very hard. So by the time he gave the I Have a Dream speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, he had already given thousands of speeches because he was a preacher.
Yeah.
And so he was constantly working on the craft. Great communicators, great speakers they're made. Absolutely, they are made. They are not born. There isn't one interesting speaker who I've interviewed or someone who's considered very charismatic who didn't put in a lot of work.
Yeah.
Steve Jobs, especially when I wrote the book on Steve Jobs, I talked to people who knew him when he first started Apple. He was an introvert. He was very nervous. He had panic attacks. He was not comfortable on stage. He would hold the lectern. There's an old video of him, 1984, like gripping the lectern, pure stage fright.
Wow.
20 years later, he was Mr. Charisma, right, on stage.
Yeah.
So I think whoever it is that you look at, I bet you that somewhere in their past, they had to work at the craft.
Yeah.
So anyone can work at the craft, but not everybody's dedicated enough to do that.
Yeah.
And it's not that easy.
No.
That's why they need some guidance and some coaching.
Absolutely. I actually do remember being in the US a while ago and going to a Martin Luther King retrospective that was in Dallas. And what fascinated me with that was that actual speech. Not only had he delivered thousands of speeches, there were seven people in his inner circle that helped him work that up over a period of about 7 or 8 weeks.
Good point. Yeah. Yes.
And that has always landed in my memory. It's always etched itself in my brain because it's like we go and we almost treat it like he ad-libbed, "I have a dream." Right?
Yes, exactly. And you can go back in history and find all of this. Winston Churchill, one of the great, you know, most inspiring speakers of our time, he worked on it as a writer and he ended up writing books on writing.
Yeah.
Abraham Lincoln. I have a wonderful book on Abraham Lincoln by a famous historian, Doris Kearns Goodwin. He was a storyteller. She even used the word storyteller in the book on Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
But Abraham Lincoln worked at it. He was like a traveling lawyer in the prairies, and he would gather stories, and he would watch these great public debates, because at the time, there was no, you know, YouTube or television, so people went to public debates, and he would go to public debates, and he'd analyze, how do these politicians do it? This gentleman's an incredible speaker. How does he do it? How does he weave in his stories? So whenever you do, whether it's historical or contemporary, anyone who is an extraordinary speaker or storyteller has probably really worked on that craft.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's for good and for evil. So, for example, Hitler with his speeches, which, you know, galvanized people in what we'd see as the wrong way for humanity, had a team of 20-something speechwriters locked away on typewriters in a basement, right? So he actually apparently wrote very few of his own speeches, full stop.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
So again, an investment in time.
It's a tool though, right? So like my books are global.
Yeah.
Anyone can use my books on communication. It's a tool like any other tool. And tools are sometimes used, you know, for ill. But most of the time, it's a critical element that the people who have great ideas, world-changing ideas, ideas to solve big problems, they're the ones who need that tool.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, it's almost impossible to be heard through the noise, and your voice deserves to be heard, but not if you can't articulate your idea in a way that grabs people's attention and really motivates them and inspires them.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess one of the people we've been speaking about, Steve Jobs, a lot, and in my rooms, because they're predominantly women, Brené Brown comes up a lot. So I have this activity that we run through, and people come in and they've all nearly... I would say 90% of the people in my rooms have watched Brené Brown as part of our pre-work exercises. Now, what they love, no matter what they take away and what it informs for them, all of them talk about her ability to land humor in her storytelling. So her ability to bring stories in, her ability to land humor. How important is humor in storytelling?
Oh, it's essential, but you have to be careful with it, okay? Yeah. Not everybody's a professional comedian.
No.
I love Brené Brown, from what I recall, is a little bit more self-deprecating humor, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other person who comes to mind that everybody should watch, Brené Brown, also watched Sir Ken Robinson. He's passed away since then.
My favorite.
Yeah. And his is so funny.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember some of the jokes. Again, it's self-deprecating. When he comes down and he says, you know, I'm an educator and I was at a dinner party. Well, you know, when you're an educator, you rarely get invited to dinner parties, but I was at a dinner party once. So it's a very self-deprecating, but it was like a laugh a minute.
Yeah.
And it was fun. It sets the tone almost immediately, and it gives you a really good vibe about a person. But you have to also be careful about humor because we're not joke writers. So I tend to not overthink it. Just don't overthink it. You don't have to start with a joke. In fact, probably preferable not to start with a joke.
Amen.
But if you simply observe, make casual anecdotal observations that might bring a smile to your face, that can be humor too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you don't have to overthink it. You don't have to make it a big deal. And then test it out. See if you get a laugh.
And, see if
and
it lands.
If you laugh at something, someone else might.
Yeah.
You know, I have a, when I give talks, I typically go back to this one concept on big picture thinking. And I'll say, you know, when our cave-dwelling ancestors ran into a tiger, they did not ask, how many teeth does the tiger have? They asked, will it eat me? Okay. And so more often than not, every time I say it, people laugh in the audience. So again, it's registering. It's not like a big setup of a joke. And it's not even really self-deprecating. It's just a humorous observation that I made once and people laugh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I kind of like that reaction.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'll do it again. And people laugh. It doesn't have to be too formal. Just be casual. The best way to use humor is casual. Not, I'm going to tell a joke here. You know,
Because
you're not a joke teller. And telling a good joke is, Jerry Seinfeld works many years on one joke. It's not that easy. So
it's not that easy at all. I actually, and I'm sure you probably hear this as well as a coach, although at a different level, but I quite often get people come up to me and say, oh, I want to get better at speaking. I know I have to be funny. And my first question is always, are you funny in real life? Because if you're not funny in real life, don't try to be funny when you speak. Just find that gentle humor.
And I would ask why?
Yeah.
Right? I have been mesmerized by a lot of speakers who are kind of humorous a little bit. You know, maybe they'll say a story or an anecdote that kind of brings a smile to your face. It shows that they're comfortable in their own skin, but they're not, I'm coming out there to be funny.
Yeah.
So that's a difference in your attitude and the way you see yourself as a speaker.
Yeah.
Brene Brown's an excellent example, though. And look, Brene Brown, perfect example of everything we're talking about, which is the power of communication.
Yeah.
Before she became a favorite on Oprah and a worldwide sensation, wasn't it because of her TED Talk? I think it was her TED Talk that came first.
It was. Her TED Talk came first. And she wasn't known, and she actually wasn't able to sell her idea with vulnerability and her first book. She wasn't able to sell it to start with. And it wasn't until she articulated beautifully on that TED stage that people started listening. So when you look at the history of her work, she could not sell her book. She could not sell her ideas. She could not get mainstream buy-in to what she was doing as an academic.
And she was able to articulate in such a beautiful way on a platform that got noticed, but the storyteller comes first. If you can't articulate, it doesn't matter what the platform is. You have to work on those tools, and then people will start noticing you. But again, I wrote this in one of my books, and I have the evidence for it. I could probably back it up on almost anything, which is almost any movement that you can think of, a movement or a major event has a storyteller or a great speaker communicator behind it somewhere, if you look back far enough.
100%.
So whether it's a Brene Brown or historical movements, there's somebody that has to be the face of that movement or to light the spark.
Yeah.
And that person is usually a good storyteller who's really worked at it.
Yeah.
Really worked at that craft.
Yeah. I'm loving this emphasis on really worked at it. When it comes to tools, there's just one more I want to touch on before we actually shift into some of the speeches. And it's in Five Stars, which is actually one of my favorite books. It's absolutely dog-eared. And you actually introduce us to four steps which make, and you're talking about JFK's speech. And you say it made it irresistibly persuasive. So number one, that sounds sublime, irresistibly persuasive. The second question is, what is it that made it so?
Yes, I'm looking at that right now. I know exactly what you're talking about. That is the moon speech where JFK convinced America to go to the moon.
Go to the moon.
A moon landing. Yes. Okay. So how do you convince people to do that when at the time, 1960, 61, 62, 63, we didn't have the technology to land an astronaut on the moon? How do you convince people to do that? So I did some research, but I also talked to people who had done the research as well and looked at NASA documents since then. Professors and other experts have looked at it. And what they found is that, you know, Kennedy, who was a poet and a storyteller, did several things. So first, he reduced the number of NASA's aspirations to one. Okay, so that tells me he's a simplifier. One idea. Same as a TED Talk. The TED organizers always tell people one big idea, not 20. So NASA was like, oh, we're going to explore space and we're going to do all these other things. Mm-hmm. Okay, how about if we just focus on exploring our closest planet? How about if we just do that? Okay, so we'll go to our moon. And then the second thing is Kennedy shifted attention from NASA's ultimate aspiration, which is to explore space, to a more concrete objective. Okay, so people like concrete, which is we're not just going to explore space, we're going to start with exploring the moon by landing on the moon. People, again, in communication, you can't give a TED Talk or any other presentation and expect to inspire people if it's too aspirational, too vague. What am I supposed to do with this? So we're going to take this vague aspiration, which is to explore space, and make it more concrete. Okay, now we have an objective. See that thing up there? It's called the moon. We're going to land on that.
Yeah.
Okay, well, now it's concrete. And then the third thing is that he communicated milestones. That was the third thing that experts found that made John F. Kennedy very persuasive. Milestones, again, specific concrete goals.
Yeah.
Not only are we going to land on that thing that we see every night, we're going to do it by the end of the decade. And scientists at the time said, but we don't have the technology. But if we had to do it by the end of the decade, what would we have to do?
It's out of the question.
Kind of spark creativity. And then the fourth thing, which gets to TED Talks and great communication, is they say Kennedy emphasized the impressive scale of the objective with metaphors, analogies, and unique figures of speech. And there you go. That's what makes for a great communicator, because he said if we reach the moon, then there is hope for knowledge and peace. And, you know, all of these values are there.
Yeah.
Are there? Knowledge and peace are sitting on the moon, wait, like a moon rock? What are you talking about? It's all metaphorical language.
But metaphorically, it works.
Yeah. Well, why did we explore Everest? You know, because it was there, you know?
Yeah.
And because there's hope for the future is there on the moon. It's like, really? On that rock floating in space? But again, that's how you inspire people. You use all of these rhetorical devices, like metaphors and analogies and figures of speech, to inspire people to think differently about a topic.
Mm.
But again, this is an advanced skill.
Yeah.
Kennedy worked at it, and Kennedy he loved poetry and loved speech writing and loved the power of words and was a big reader and a writer. This isn't easy.
No.
To do it on the scale that we're talking about takes work, takes commitment, and it also requires that people like you and me and others we're coming to it from different fields, but we're reaching some of the similar conclusions, but from different fields. So there's different ways of looking at it, because persuasion is so difficult that we all have to try our best to learn different tactics and ways of doing it.
Yeah, it's really, and I just love this emphasis, because I say to people all the time, this is a craft, and like any craft, to get to mastery, it takes time and commitment and conviction. And one of the things that you just actually touched on with JFK is the rhetoric. And you actually bring this up in Five Stars. You actually talk about rhetoric. You talk about the definition of rhetoric, and it's actually the ancient definitions, and it was so powerful. And I think for me, and this is a personal question, because I really lean into the Hebrew origins of abracadabra. We create what we speak, which ties into the storytelling and how we light each other up. But I would love to know, what is it that has your attention when it comes to rhetoric, and why do you think it really matters from a speaking perspective? What we can pull out of rhetoric and rhetoric proofs that really accelerate our ability to engage through the spoken word?
Well, I think that going back to the classical definition, rhetoric is the art of persuasion.
Yeah.
And what we do every day, we're persuading every day in small ways. I call it the small P's and then big P, big persuasion. So convincing people to take action on a particular climate initiative, that's big persuasion. That's hard to do. But you convincing me by sending me an email and saying, I'd love to have you on this podcast. Okay, well, that's still persuasion, right? And it worked. So we're persuading every day. And yeah. What I've learned is that the ancient art of persuasion, especially if you go back to Aristotle, this is the fun part of what I get to do. I love history. I love the research. It's still relevant today. So when he talked about ethos, logos, and pathos as being part of a great speech, ethos being character and credibility, logos being logic, that's yeah. where your facts and figures come in. But you also need pathos, which is emotion, story.
Yeah, storytelling.
And so the way screenwriters, for example, in Hollywood write screenplays, a lot of it is taken from the father of persuasion, which is Aristotle,
yeah.
who was the first to say a story has a beginning, middle, and an end.
You know? Yeah.
So it's, we haven't changed that much.
No, we haven't.
But what I'd like to look at these ancient storytelling tools and apply them to today's world.
What's your favorite storytelling tool?
Probably the ethos, logos, pathos, I think is really important because it's a rhetorical device. It's an ancient rhetorical formula
yeah.
for creating a persuasive presentation or at that time a speech. But it doesn't yeah. matter, does it? Because they didn't have a TED Talk.
No.
Abe Lincoln didn't have a TED stage. He had a
no.
tree stump.
Yes, he did.
He literally had a tree stump. He would get on yeah. but he would tell stories. The
yeah.
same thing is what TED is asking people to do today. Tell a story.
Yeah.
And then you can use the data and the logic to back up your story, but you should either start with a story or have a story as a critical element of your presentation.
Yeah.
Because you could also start in different ways.
Yeah.
We want to be unique and creative within the structure.
Boom.
So wouldn't it be cool to come out with a real hard-hitting statistic or metric or a data point? Well, that's also another good way of doing it. So I'm going
Absolutely.
To grab your attention, and now I'm going to come in with a story. But if it's all data and no story, well, that goes back to Aristotle, who said that's not going to work.
Yeah.
It's not going to persuade.
Yeah. It's interesting. We've got to learn these lessons over and over again as people telling stories. When it comes to the TED Talks, like for me, looking at your trajectory, it's a logical progression for you to go and unpack the TED Talks. What have you loved about moving into that and really, really diving deep under the hood with the TED Talks? What have you loved?
I enjoy the concept of being able to speak for, say, let's say 10 minutes, because not all TED Talks are 18 minutes. So whether it's 10 minutes or 15 minutes, to be able to get an idea across and to change the way people look at things
yeah.
or to reframe an entire topic or get or inspire people to action on a particular topic, and to do that in 10 minutes or 18 minutes, that's an amazing skill to have.
Yeah. Huh.
One of the great TED speakers who I enjoy watching was Bryan Stevenson.
Yes.
And Bryan has a wonderful talk. He changed some of what he did as a human rights attorney here in the U.S. I've talked to him about this. You know, he changed the law on the, he's won cases in front of the Supreme Court, and the laws have changed because of some of the things he argued. So here's a guy who, through the power of his words, can actually change things for, you know, today and the future for millions of people who are in the incarcerated or in the criminal justice system. That's amazing to me. How do you do
yeah.
that through words?
Yeah.
I'm constantly, constantly fascinated by this. I don't always have all the answers. Because like I said, right, if we did, we convince anybody of anything. But how do you do that through words? That's a pretty powerful skill. But it's a skill that we can always learn from, which is why
right.
I enjoy talking to you and working with people who are giving TED Talks. It's always fun because I'm learning something new all the time.
Every time.
Maybe a completely different way of presenting information I hadn't even thought of before.
What do you think makes, or what do you know to be true about what makes a TED Talk powerful? So if somebody's thinking, I'm going to go and do a TED Talk, we know that a lot of people have it on their bucket list. What do we need to be mindful of? What is actually the structure of a great TED Talk that makes it so powerful?
Well, first of all, realize that people need simplicity.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you keep it simple is one theme. And that was a big revelation to me. I didn't realize until I started writing about TED Talks and talking to TED organizers, I didn't realize that more often than not, a speaker will say, how am I expected to get everything I know across in just 18 minutes?
Yeah.
Well, the answer is you don't. You're not expected. In fact, it's preferable if you don't tell us everything you know in 18 minutes. So that's number one. You have to realize that I'm going to pick one big idea, one concept, and then everything else is going to support that concept. I call it a log line. TED Talks call it a through line.
Yes.
I've seen other people call it a headline. I don't really care what you call it. What's interesting is we're arriving at the same conclusions from different fields. The point is, what is your talk in one sentence? You got to start there. Even when you go to TED.com, they label the talk.
In one sentence.
Well, those talks can easily fit within like 120 characters or less. There are a few words. How can you describe your talk in The Power of Vulnerability, right? Brené Brown. Oh, okay. Vulnerability. Power and vulnerability? What? Right? The Power of Introverts. Remember Susan Cain's TED Talk?
Yes.
Which I love, too. But again, there's power, and they're using kind of a similar structure. Power in something that you didn't expect would have power. Oh, that's interesting. That's attention-grabbing. But it's only one sentence. So I think this applies to TED Talks. I think it applies to any good pitch or presentation. And I've heard venture capitalists in Silicon Valley tell me this too. If you can't explain your idea in a sentence and then everything else supports it, they're not interested.
No.
They want to hear it and get it simply and concisely. The same with a good TED Talk. So I think there's a structure to a good TED Talk, but within that structure, you can be endlessly creative.
Absolutely.
And that's what I like to help people understand.
I'm fascinated with structures. I love to modelize everything and understand through a structure perspective. Right. But actually not because I'm a lover of structure. I love to not be boxed in and not hemmed in. What I discovered actually in my days in industrial relations and human resources is the more structure we have in the foundation, the more creative we get. And I think you just summed that up perfectly, is the stronger the structure in the foundation, the more creative we can get. So, you know, I would walk into organizations who tell me, I want to be in the top 50 employers of choice and be like, your people don't even know how to find their leave form right now.
And it's interesting that you came to that conclusion from industrial relations. Again, it's different fields, but you're reaching that conclusion.
It's exactly the same thing, you know. And so when somebody is actually deciding to or choosing to do a TED Talk, if you're coming in, what's the first couple of questions you'd be asking them to make sure that they're ready to invest what needs to be done to get there? What would you actually be asking them to make sure they're clear and they're ready to go?
A couple of things. There's a lot of different ways of asking a question to elicit, you know, the best structure or the best stories and the best talk. I like to know, what is it that you're going to teach me? What are you teaching me that I don't know?
Yeah.
So I think that's a good question. Like, you know, you got to teach in order to really stand out, get attention, not only on the TED platform, because now there's more and more TED Talks, but in almost any public speaking opportunity, you've got to teach people something new, something I haven't thought of before, or a completely different way of looking at an existing problem. So you have to have something behind you that's interesting or unique. And so we got to start there, okay? Not everything can be a good TED Talk.
Yeah.
It has to actually teach you something. The social media is full of people and full of speakers who really don't teach you anything.
No, sound bites.
It's derivative. Yeah, sound bites are their derivative. They're not interesting. So teach me something new, but also do it in a way that is novel and memorable and exciting. And that breaks those patterns that's unexpected, you know? And so that's where you can really get creative.
Yeah, absolutely. So when it comes to TED Talks, you've mentioned Brian Stevenson, Ken Robinson. We've spoken about Brené Brown.
Yep.
Who else is your favorites?
Susan Cain, you know she was an introvert.
Yes.
I've talked to her about this. She was an introvert. She was terrified of public speaking. And she gave one of the most popular, most viewed TED Talks of all time. Interesting, isn't it? Again, there's a formula to get there. There's a formula for working at it.
When I first got obsessed with this myself, I remember years ago being on the other side, so the conference organizer, and I would always make sure I had the opportunity to pick keynote speakers up and things like that because I wanted to spend more time with them and find out more about them. And one of the things that fascinated me that I love that Susan Cain brought to the fore is most great speakers are, in actual point of fact, the majority of the time introverts. They've worked at this. Yeah. It's a craft that mattered to them. So they had a cause bigger than themselves that got them out of their own way of being an introvert. So when I would like be picking them up and wanting this great conversation, they'd be like, can you just leave me in peace?
Yeah. Well, you know, introverts are thoughtful. They're more thoughtful and they're good listeners.
Yeah.
Okay. And so they're listening. They're constantly picking up ideas, picking up things. And you can be a phenomenal speaker and be an introvert at the same time, which is kind of interesting, you know? So you could be a socially introverted, but publicly very powerful speaker. Hey, one quick thing before I forget, we were talking about the questions that I ask. Okay. Yeah. So teach me something new, but here's the other question has to do with why should I watch this particular, why should I watch you on this particular topic? Give me a reason to watch the movie. I like to almost think of it in movie terms so that when you're at a cocktail party or you're on a Zoom with a friend or you bump into somebody, oh, I just watched this movie. It was great. You should watch it too. And it's usually one or two sentences. It's like, here's why you should watch this movie or here's why you would like this movie. Okay. That's the way we talk to each other when a movie comes out or there's something on Netflix that you should watch. Well, I want to hear the same thing about a presentation or a TED Talk. Why should I watch the movie? Okay. So not only are what are you doing?
I think that's the best question I've heard.
Good. Okay, good. Yeah, I'm glad.
That is the best question I've heard. Yeah.
Because that's hard. It's not always an easy answer and people don't have an answer. And when they don't have an answer, my red flag goes up. Like, man, I think we better work on this a little bit more. Because if you put me to sleep, then there's no reason for me to watch the movie. How are we going to stand out? In one sentence, what's this movie about? Get me excited about it.
Yeah. What's the viral version? What's the viral sentence that everyone's going to be using about what you're speaking about? Incredible. Carmine, our time is almost at an end. Is it okay if I ask you six very quick questions as we wrap this out?
Sure. Thanks. Absolutely.
Okay. So the first question I'm going to ask for those listening to this who believe they can never be a great storyteller or speaker, what would you say to them?
Every great public speaker who I've written about or who I've met was made, not born. It takes practice, but you can get there.
Made, not born is going to be the quote of the day, I think.
Yeah.
For those who are actually listening along to us who actually already believe that they're an amazing speaker and storyteller, what would you say to them?
Well, that's the opposite of having a growth mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Growth mindset is you're constantly learning something new.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the best TED speakers who I've talked to, people who have top 10 TED Talks of all time, they said that they learned something, even though they had been extraordinary speakers for many, many years, they learned something from going through the TED experience that they didn't know before. That tells me that the reason why they're good speakers is because they're humble enough to always learn something new.
Love that. Lifelong obsession. Here we come. The best speech that you've ever actually delivered, where do you think that was?
I gave a talk to 10,000 financial professionals in New Orleans once. That took a lot of practice, and I'm glad I did the practice because when you're on a stage that big, it's uncomfortable. It's not something that you're used to doing.
Mm.
And so it took a lot of practice to get there. But that's when I learned the power of practice.
Yeah.
Oh, if I practice on a big stage, even if it's an empty auditorium, it will feel a little more natural when I actually get there.
I love that. It's actually come up in a few of the conversations we've been having with people is practicing in that environment.
Good.
Yeah. The best speech you've ever heard. I know that's a hard one.
Oh, well, there's too many because I love so many of the TED speeches. But whether it's a TED speech or the JFK moon landing, 1963, Rice University is where you should look. And not just the inaugural. The inaugural was a little more abstract.
Okay.
But what we just talked about regarding, you know, more concrete rhetorical tools you're going to find in the moon landing speech. It's called the moon speech. And let's not forget, going back to Steve Jobs, how about the Steve Jobs commencement address?
One of my favorite of all time. Yeah.
It's all storytelling. Yeah. He even says, I'm going to start by telling you three stories. Isn't it interesting? As that's one of the most popular commencement speeches of all time, and it's all storytelling.
100% story. And it is. Yeah. I stumbled across it accidentally years ago, and it still is bookmarked. I don't ever want to lose that copy of that speech. The speech that you wish you could have helped them. So someone that you know that you really wish you could have dug in and helped them with what they delivered.
Every day.
Every day?
There isn't one, right? Because every single day I see professionals or people or companies that I know. If I know the story behind something, whether it's technical or a company or a product, if I know a little bit more of the story and I hear someone tell it in a way that is just obtuse and convoluted and confusing, I want to tear my hair out. That happens every day. I want to help somebody.
I actually now feel like I'm somewhat normal having heard you say that. You still feel like that.
It's very hard to watch TV sometimes because you're just tearing your hair out.
Absolutely.
You could have done so much better with that.
Yeah, I agree totally. I almost rant and rave sometimes at video and TVs. It's, my children think I'm insane. Come on, what's next?
What's next is probably doing audio. I'm doing some original audios.
Oh.
So that's what's next. You know, taking what I've written into books and doing some, not podcasting, but original audios for a publisher. So that's going to be next, but I hope to announce something soon.
That's exciting. I'm looking forward to hearing whatever that format takes. Yep. Come on, Gallo. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Speaker Driven Business. And if you have, I'd love you to do two things for me. Number one, subscribe to the show so you never miss an episode. And number two, leave a review so other people can find and enjoy the content we share. Online, you can find us on Instagram and connect with me personally on LinkedIn. Just head to anygiventuesday.com.au and you will find all the connection points there. Speaker Driven Business is the show making speaking-driven strategies accessible to everyone, and I am honored you tuned in.